Well, current state scheduled pop-up stories event, the Call of the Wild, got called last week because of the weather, unfortunately. We have rescheduled that live storytelling session for 1 week from tonight at Valley Court Park in East Lansing. We get started at 7 o'clock, I do believe. 7 o'clock at Valley Court Park. Stories of the outdoors, nature, wildlife, close encounters in the outdoors. I mean, the sky is the limit when it comes to this topic. We hope you can join us. More information at our Facebook page for Pop-Up Stories, which is Pop-Up Stories Lansing. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back to Current State. Yesterday, voters determined candidates for Michigan's upcoming general election here in mid-Michigan. Those include Ingham County Prosecutor, State House Districts, County Sheriff candidates, and others. Several ballot proposals were also decided, among them millage for a new Ingham County animal shelter. To analyze the results, we welcome Susan J. Demas, owner and publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you.
And Mickey Hurton joins us, associate publisher and columnist for the Lansing City Pulse. Mickey, good to see you.
Good morning.
Lots to look at here. Let's start with the Ingham County Prosecutor's primary, and we will eventually get to yesterday's developments involving Stuart Dunnings here in a minute. But regarding the vote, Carol Seaman, the winner on the Democratic side, by a pretty healthy margin. Billie Jo O'Berry among the two Republicans. She managed to prevail. Any thoughts on the outcome here, Susan?
Well, it was a four-way Democratic primary, so Carol Seaman ran a pretty impressive campaign. She had a good social media presence. She was running ads on TV, and she managed to really consolidate the progressive vote in the county.
Democrats had choices here. I mean, four choices, yeah, on the Democratic side, and the Republicans had two.
And she had a lot of endorsements, and she also used social media pretty well. I mean, you could hardly pick up a Google search without her popping up there, and so a pretty effective campaign.
And with regard to Billie Jo O'Berry, any thoughts there? With Republicans had two options. She's a familiar face, to be sure, here in the Lansing area.
Yeah, she's been a frequent candidate for judge, and so I think a lot of people are aware of the name. They've seen the signs, and so name ID is very helpful. Being a Republican running in Ingham County is not.
Yes. I mean, when you look at the turnout, I mean, it's clear that the Democrats prevail in almost every category. So it's nice. And she's probably the most well-known candidate on the Republican side, but very unlikely to win.
I would like to, before we go any further, let's stick with the prosecutor's office here for one more minute. We had Stuart Dunnings in the middle of course, pleading guilty to two prostitution-related charges yesterday. Let's talk about this just a little bit. Mickey, you've already got a piece in City Pulse about it. Your thoughts on the guilty plea?
Well, I mean, he could have done 26 and a half years in jail. I mean, that was the potential. And that considered, he's got a five-year potential felony and 93 days on another charge. I mean, he got off fairly easy. And the question is, what happened? I mean, when they announced the charges, it was Schutte and the sheriff, and they were, you know, hundreds of episodes led to this arrest. And now they've downgraded all of this. I mean, it's really incredible. What happened to all of these charges? And what happened to the commitment against human trafficking that Dunnings now gets relatively light sentence? One is a downgrade of the pandering charge and one count of prostitution. So it's very odd. And it would be interesting to see some of the documents now that they can no longer hide all this behind, it's in process, see what really happened.
You inclined to agree, Susan? What do you think?
I am. And, you know, I think there are still open questions about who else was aware of what was going on, both in the prosecutor's office, but also with law enforcement.
Law enforcement, I think, is the gravest one. I mean, you know, the sheriff's department acknowledged that they've heard about this for years. Well, what kind of investigations actually took place, and how serious was it in trying to pursue this? And, you know, it was no one's political interest to go after Dunnings. And the other question I raise in my comments, what does Dunnings know and isn't sane as part of the plea deal. I mean, he's essentially silenced. But it's hard to believe that the prosecutor, to me, with 20 years experience in a state capital, which isn't the cleanest place in the world, doesn't know something about someone, and it's in all of their interest to keep it quiet.
Well, could the Dunnings situation become become an issue in the election for sheriff? That's the other thing. We will hire a new sheriff in November. Is that possible?
Who is and the front runner is the current sheriff's son, Scott Rigglesworth. This potentially could be an issue, but once again, it's very difficult for a Republican to win in this county.
Right.
The question is, maybe it becomes an issue in the prosecutor's race, because you will have O'Berry against Siemens, and O'Berry is clearly an outsider. But, you know, Whitmer's in there now, and she really doesn't have any reason not to look deeply into this, I don't think. So we'll see. But there's more of a story in there that's got to be.
Well, since we're talking about Billie Jo O'Berry, I'm pleased to welcome her to the program, the successful Republican candidate for Ingham County Prosecutor. Billie Jo O'Berry joins us briefly on the phone here. Thanks for carving out time for us here today, Billie Jo.
You're very welcome. Yes, I was in court, and I just ran down a flight of stairs just to get your call.
I think our guests have raised a valid point here. It is you are running for prosecutor in a blue county. How do you expect to prevail in November? What do you need to get in front of voters?
Well, this transcends party politics. We have had a breach of trust here in Ingham County, and the thing that people need to look at is who's going to perpetuate the kind of system that occurred that allowed Stuart Dunnings to engage in the activities that he engaged in. And if you look at the list of supporters for Carol Seaman, who is running, it's the same list of supporters that supported Stuart Dunnings year after year after year. We need to clear that slate. We need to start fresh. And I just caught the tail end of what you were saying about O'Berry being an outsider. That is true. As far as with the party politics, I'm an outsider with respect to partisanship. However, with the community, I am very much a part of this community. I've worked for 30 years in Ingham County in the city of Lansing. I've served the city of Lansing as an assistant city attorney doing prosecution. I'm the only candidate currently prosecuting cases, and as I just said, I ran down from court where I'm in court this morning. And Carol Seaman, on the other hand, has been retired since 1995 from the prosecutor's office. No one is getting that information out. In 20 years, look at the changes that have been made in technology. E-tickets, DNA testing, all of those things didn't even occur when Carol Seaman was last in court.
Can we get back to the prosecutor's race, though? Do you believe that there are guilty parties within the prosecutor's office?
Well, when you use the term guilty, infers
that people that knew understood that what Dunnings was doing and chose not to reveal it.
I believe it's very difficult in an office, even the size of 50, not to know that your prosecutor, your chief law enforcement officer, is absent for significant periods of time. It's beyond me how that's even possible, unless people there were concentrating on their own issues and their own inner workings within the office. I mean, interrelationships and things like that. So you need to step back and say, everyone out there can understand, and people that I've talked to door to door say, we just don't believe that no one knew nothing. There had to be suspicions. And let me even tell you more. If you're connected to the community like I am, people tell you things. That's how most crimes are solved, is by from the street level. Gene Rigglesworth, our sheriff, said that they had heard rumors. Why did no one investigate that? If you hear rumors about your top law enforcement official, that needs to be investigated immediately.
So is what you're saying is that Carol Seaman should be held accountable for Stuart Dunnings' behavior and his crimes in this next election?
No, absolutely not.
But
however,
by voters, not in a legal sense, by voters.
You have to look at the party that has perpetuated this. The same supporters supported Stuart Dunnings and said 4 years ago they told this community that he was the best candidate to be the Ingham County prosecuting attorney. Those same people are now saying Carol Seaman's the best person to be the Ingham County prosecutor. What credibility is there when they supported just 4 years ago an individual who has now pled guilty to violating the laws of this state?
We are going to let Billie Joe O'Berry go here. We've got other developments here from the primary vote to talk with about our guest. Billie Joe O'Berry, many thanks for joining us today. Good luck.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Certainly. It's Current State here. My guests are Susan J. Demas, owner and publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. Mickey Hurton is associate publisher and columnist for Lansing City Pulse. Let's stay with county results for another minute before we discuss the State House winners in our area. Five millage proposals in Ingham, including a new animal shelter millage, all passing. Ingham residents seem to be supportive of their services these days.
I'm not sure you could put a tax increase on the ballot that wouldn't pass in Ingham County.
But, you know, it strikes me, I'm trying to reconcile the sort of the good news on these on the elections, because virtually all incumbents won. The millage has passed, and I'm only trying to say we have a national election now where people are supposed to be angry.
The same thing crossed my mind as I woke up this morning.
And
I mean,
where is it?
There's a lot of places where it's really not good to be an incumbent. And what do we see locally? We see a totally different kind of vibe.
I think that's the feeling. I mean, and Michigan is supposed to be a state that's in play. Mm-hmm. In the election. So if this is the general tenor of the Michigan electorate, Michigan isn't in play. People seem to be happy here, and the economy in the state has improved sufficiently that they ought to be.
And it's not just what happened in Blue Ingham County yesterday. If you look statewide, not a single incumbent state House
right.
member lost. You would expect to see different results in a year of the so-called angry voter.
We had four state House incumbents in our area facing challengers yesterday, and as we've alluded, they were all successful. Democrats Andy Shore and Tom Cochran, and Republicans Tom Leonard and Brett Roberts. Any particular thoughts on any of those four outcomes?
They probably all win re-election in November.
Yeah.
I mean, we're just not seeing the revolt. You know, the groundswell of dissatisfaction that you might expect.
I agree. I mean, I think you certainly have a segment that's angry, but not overall.
Yeah, yeah.
We have, it appears nothing was really decided in the 8th Congressional District here yesterday. There was really nothing to decide, as best as I can tell. Some number of people probably wrote in Susanna Shrelly's name, and Melissa Gilbert obviously has some hoops to jump through to officially get her name off the November ballot, so that lay with the Bureau of Elections to decide. But Susan, you made the rounds yesterday. Let's talk a little bit about outstate here. I know you put in a lot of miles yesterday. Where were you, and what did you see? What did you hear?
Yeah, over the last couple of days, I was in Grand Rapids, Detroit, Brighton. Didn't make it up to Flint, but that's probably today. So. What you're seeing is that millages across the state did pretty well. Incumbents did pretty well. And we have to see the final turnout numbers, but it's not looking very positive.
We had an interesting number of races, though, and kind of an interesting dynamic in Meridian Township that I'd like to touch on here before we go any further. There was a race for trustees, and there was this issue of the bus rapid transit, which was percolating just below the surface.
Not that far below the surface.
Not very far.
Meridian.
Indeed.
It sort of was split. I mean, you had Duchesne won and Jackson won and Opsomer won. They were part of a ticket that was sort of for it with Brixie, and they, you know, sort of support it. But then others went back. I mean, so we're still going to be something of a split there. It's hard to gauge how much people really feel about this issue. Clearly, the business community dislikes it for the disruption that will happen, the cost, and the sort of the change in traffic patterns. But it looks to me as if the Meridian board that got elected yesterday is likely to support this. I think this is probably, they've got sufficient votes.
Previously they have formally come out against it, but this is now we're in a post-election, primary mode here, so that I suppose that may change. There was quite a bit of heat generated in the first congressional district in the UP. Jason Allen, Tom Casperson, Jack Bergman amongst the Republicans, Lon Johnson and Jerry Cannon amongst the Democrats. What happened in the first, Susan?
This was the shocker. When I was up in the Western UP and Lower UP in June, it was a very quiet race, and it really looked like it was Casperson versus Allen on the GOP side. This race was just broken wide open in the last few weeks, and you had Allen and Casperson beating each other up, and the outsider Jack Bergman, a retired general who doesn't even spend very much time in Michigan, slipped through. This is going to be an absolutely fascinating general election. And Lon Johnson, the former Democratic Party chair, got exactly the result that he wanted.
We have got to leave it there. We could talk for longer, but we've got to go. We want to thank our guests. Susan Demas is owner and publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. Mickey Hurton is the associate publisher and columnist for the Lansing City Pulse. Look for his column involving the Stuart Dunning's plea here in the new edition. Thank you very much for joining us.
Have a good day, Mark.
You might know of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It's often called SNAP, which provides benefits to low-income individuals and families. But did you know about SNAP Ed? It involves a series of different food education and cooking classes for adults and youth. For Neighbors in Action here this week on Current State, we'll speak with the people running these programs in mid-Michigan. That's on the way. And speaking of food, a program at Allen Neighborhood Center is teaching job and life skills to youth, including how to garden. They maintain the public garden at Hunter Park, Lansing, and even cook with the food they harvest and sell it at Allen Marketplace. Every Friday this summer, they're offering free tours of the garden, along with samples of what they're growing. Current State's Katie Cook went for one of these edible tours last Friday, and the young participants taught her how to keep tomato plants going straight, growing straight up, and explain the exquisite taste of ground cherries.
What do we have over here, you guys?
This is strawberries.
Strawberries.
They didn't do so good this season because of how hot and dry it was. Yeah.
All right. The majority.
Stephanie Ondershannon really likes her job.
I love it. I feel really lucky that this is what I get to do for a living.
As the Youth Programs Coordinator at the Allen Neighborhood Center, she leads the Youth Services Corps, or YSC. It's a job and life skills training program for 11 to 17-year-olds. And one of their projects is to maintain the portion of Hunter Park Garden, which is open to the public.
How long has this program been going on?
So Youth Service Corps as a program was the first program of the Allen Neighborhood Center, which began 17 years ago. This garden has been in existence, I think, about 6 years.
So walk me through the different components of the Youth Service Corps.
Okay, so we care for this garden here in Hunter Park, but then we have other projects. We have our Garden in a Box project, which we finished earlier. Well, we did it earlier this summer. It's still going on, where we delivered 20 2x2 square foot boxes with soil, plants, seeds, and everything to get people started on gardening completely free. We have our fruit tree project, where we track, we map and track fruit trees around the east side, and then harvest when there's like extra produce. We have the park cart, which is where we sell at the farmer's market, and so we take what we've harvested from here at the garden and cook with it in the kitchen on Wednesday mornings, and then sell it Wednesday afternoons at the farmer's market. And then during the school year, since gardening is not always an option in like winter and everything, we do stuff in the fall, like rake and runs, where we'll go and like rake neighbors' lawns and like leave a note like, hey, we raked your lawn, gotcha. And like do a lot of like projects with like it's a job prep or like job training program. That's how we like sell it to grantors. And so there's a lot of like during the spring, we did a lot of like resume prep and customer service skills and writing how to do it in an interview and stuff. So as the season changes, what we do changes.
And do you plan out what you're going to plant in the garden, or do any of the kids have a say in that?
We like consult with them. So we went through Johnny's seeds, the catalog, and like we're like, oh, this would be fun, but it's like the really crazy plants. And we have like a stockpile of extra seeds. So we like surveyed them, and they like were like, okay, we want to grow these things. And from our like stockpile of seeds, we then did that. So it's not the dream ones, it's not like the crazy striped like tomatoes and like the weird looking squashes, but they have input in it.
And how can kids get involved in this? How does the application process work?
It's a really simple registration form. It's available at Allen Neighborhood Center's website as something that's downloadable. But like, if you're not able to print that out, you can stop by our outreach office, and the paper applications are available there. And then you fill it out, give it to someone, then I take it. I just have to talk to the parent to get confirmation that they're okay with their youth being involved, and then they can get started.
And it's free to participate?
It's free to participate, yeah.
Joe and Dominic lead me on a tour through the garden, along with Stephanie and the rest of the group.
Okay. We have our kale. We have a few different kinds. We have the dinosaur kale. We have Russian kale. I'm not quite sure what that one is. I forgot the name.
Toscano.
Toscano kale.
Have you tasted all these?
Yeah, we've had a bunch of them.
Which is your favorite?
Probably the dinosaur kale. Tastes really good.
Also a really cool name.
Yeah, also the best name ever. We made salad with it, with some peppers. It was really good. We made dressing for it. Here we have our peppers. They're starting to bud, so that's good. And then we have our eggplants. I actually haven't had eggplant before, ever. I'm gonna try some though. They're also starting to grow. We have a few small ones. There's one right under there. There's one right there.
They did real good last summer.
They're really purple already.
Mm-hmm. All of these plants are tomatoes. We're working on taking out the suckers and putting them up through the cages so that they'll grow up instead of sideways.
Oh, that's very smart. Now, what exactly are the suckers?
They're like these things, and they grow in if, like, you see two branches growing off of the main branch.
This is a sucker right here.
It'll be right in between them.
Yeah. So, basically, you want to just pick that.
And why are we picking the suckers?
They don't grow out as much, and they grow up taller.
And the stronger branches will have more energy to produce fruit.
We got our sage. These are the smaller ones. We got a bunch of big ones down there. We also have our basil, I think it is.
So well.
It's not doing so well. We think something is eating them. Sad little plants.
Yeah, they look really pathetic.
Yeah, they look
They taste pretty good, though.
So what we have here are our ground cherries, and ground cherries are they taste kind of pineapple-y. So they grow, and then they form this casing. They form this casing around the ground cherry, and that basically prevents it from not getting like dirty, not getting like damaged during the process of it growing. And once it drops down to the ground, and you basically take all the cherries that are in the husks, and then we take them out of the husks, and then the ground cherries are there and ready to make anything that we want.
What do we have back here, y'all?
Raspberries.
What's your favorite kind of the raspberry?
The white golden raspberries.
You have golden raspberries?
Yeah.
They're over there and over there.
Yum.
Why do you like them better?
Because they just taste better, in my opinion.
We have spearmint, we have winter mint, and we have peppermint. I've tried all three of them. They're all pretty good. They all taste like toothpaste. I've made toothpaste and bubblegum out of both.
How'd you do that?
Well, with the bubblegum, you have to order a special like box online, and it'll give you all the utensils and things you need to make bubblegum, and it tastes pretty good. With the toothpaste, it's like water, baking soda, and a few other ingredients. It tasted just like store-bought toothpaste. If you want to make it, it's really easy.
After the tour, I have some more questions. And Alicia talks to me about her experience.
Did you guys like eating vegetables before you started working with this garden?
Yes.
A little bit. 50-50.
Yeah.
They were kind of just there to me, but I try to eat them more often now that I joined the program.
Did you try anything new after you started learning how to garden?
Yeah, when we have stuff to harvest, we try it sometimes when we're picking it, and I wouldn't normally do that, but hey, it's something new, so I do.
What's something you've had that was new?
Ground cherries, and they were spectacular. Let me just say that. I'm so happy I actually tried them because they're really good.
Do you just eat them plain, or do you put them in anything?
Well, you can make certain recipes through just using the ground cherries. Like, you can make granola bars and jams that we do, and then we sell it. So that's a lot of fun.
What have you learned from doing this program?
We learned how to prune the tomatoes today, so that was kind of cool. I didn't know that you actually even had to do that in the first place, so.
What kind of things can go wrong with a garden?
Bug infestation. We had to do caterpillar clean out this morning, so that was kind of gross, but hey, you gotta do what you gotta do to make the garden better.
How do you do caterpillar clean out?
Well, we had to take these, like, I'm just going to say sticks. They were just giant sticks, basically. And we kind of wound up the web that was around it, and then we went and then we cleared out all the caterpillars themselves. So that was an interesting task, I could say.
Where were they?
They were all in the fruit trees, and we're trying to get rid of them to make sure the fruit trees have time to produce fruit before they eat everything.
Joe chimes in, too, with an answer for what can go wrong.
Yeah, like, if you're trying to move compost, if you dump the wheelbarrow, it's really fun to clean up.
Yeah.
Especially if you put it on an angle, it'll all fall over.
Or when it tips a little bit, oh my gosh.
Trying to get it to tip back once the wheelbarrow is already tipping,
yes.
It's a nightmare. It's a nightmare.
Despite the hard work and some of these gross aspects of gardening, Alicia says it's still better than just buying your produce at the store.
You feel more accomplished when you actually get to harvest what you've been working on all this time, and then you get to taste it, and it just even tastes better because you know what you did to put the work into it, and you finally get the reward, and it's pretty good. It's amazing, to say the least.
If you want your own tour of Hunter Park Garden, stop by any Friday this summer between 10 and noon, and the Youth Services Corps will gladly show you around. For Current State, I'm Katie Cook.
And coming up on Current State, the burning bed, the Bath school bombing. Those are just two of the most notorious murder scenes in Michigan's history. They are detailed in the new book, Blood on the Mitten. Current State's Brooke Allen speaks with award-winning journalist and author Tom Carr coming up after the break on Current State. Current State, three times every weekday here on WKAR, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 FM. You can catch us on our AM station, AM 870, every day at 12 noon. Don't forget Current State Weekend. We're here 7 days a week all together. Catch it all, always, at WKAR.org. Individuals and families struggling to make ends meet can qualify for governmental food aid through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. That's known as SNAP, of course, but food stamps alone aren't always enough. That's where SNAP Ed comes in. The goal of SNAP Ed is to improve the likelihood that persons eligible for SNAP will make healthy choices within a limited budget and choose active lifestyles. Here to tell us how they do that here in mid-Michigan, SNAP Ed Nutrition Program Instructor Joe Hammondtree. Welcome, Joe.
Good morning.
And supervising educator Annette Sokolnicki. Annette, welcome.
Hello.
Annette, SNAP Ed is federally funded, and it's all made available around Michigan through MSU Extension. How does MSU Extension decide where to go with these programs?
We go to schools and sites that qualify, and we qualify them at the schools by whether they have free or reduced lunches. And sites also like a federally funded housing programs and things like that, community centers that fall in zip codes that are at or below the poverty level.
And Cooking Matters, I know, is one of your most popular classes. Talk to us about how that works.
Cooking Matters is a wonderful program. It's a six-week program where we teach participants to cook. We teach them kitchen skills. We teach them to talk like a chef, use a knife, and also how to navigate a grocery store and make healthy choices. And all the meals we make through Cooking Matters are feed a family of four for $10 and under.
And do you teach microwave skills in that?
No.
Now, that was kind of a joke question here. There's probably better ways, better things to teach about preparation of food than how to turn on the microwave. But you also do grocery store tours as part of the curriculum. What happens on those?
We take our participants to a local grocery store, and we walk them through. We look at shelf tags and help them learn how to read the price per unit for each item and comparing different name brands to the store brand to see what is the best value for their dollars.
Joe, you're an instructor in Shiawassee County. Give us an overview of the classes that you teach.
So with MSU Extension, we actually have quite a few different curriculums that we can use. And it really depends on the audience that we want to work with. If it's a Cooking Matters class, typically we're working with families who have children. If we have curriculums that work with senior citizens, we have curriculums that work with the cognitively impaired audiences, as well as youth audiences. And, you know, we can really work with anyone in the state as long as they're receiving or eligible for those state benefits.
You've said that you see changes in the people who participate in these classes from the first class to the last, which is good news, I suppose. Talk to us about that. How do people make their way through the classes? When it works, what's that like?
So MSU curriculums are what we call evidence-based. So we do pre- and post-evaluations with each participant. And what that shows us is where they're at at the beginning of class and at the end of class. And what we see through our programming is an increase in fruits and vegetable consumption. So we're seeing people actually getting more fruits and vegetables in their diet because of taking MSU Extension classes. We see an increase in physical activity. We see an increase in knowledge on label reading and price per unit reading. So the grocery store tours come in handy with that. And, you know, we talk to our participants and they tell us how successful they are afterwards after taking our classes, whether or not it's getting their kids to try something new or even themselves trying something new.
It sounds like just a big awareness raising exercise to me.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. You alluded to this before, but you work with adults with cognitive disabilities. How have you seen these classes empower them?
So in Shiawassee County, we partner with the Community Mental Health and the ARC. And one thing, you know, is sometimes people consider that group where they don't self-sustain themselves. And really, it's a group that they can cook, they can clean, they can, you know, live on their own. And by going into those classes, we're teaching them that, you know, like you said earlier, the microwave is not the best way to cook everything.
Right.
And, you know, basic knife skills and basic education, you know, what the food groups are and where, you know, they can buy the cheapest produce to get the best for their dollars. And, you know, we really see, we have parents that come up to us in the grocery store and say, oh, you're the reason we have to have a fruit and a vegetable at every meal now.
We're talking about the SNAP Ed Nutrition Program. Our guests are Joe Hammondtree, who works in Shiawassee County, and Annette Sokolnicki, who is a supervising educator, and the whole thing unfolds under the oversight of MSU Extension. Where do these classes take place in Ingham County?
Annette? In Ingham County, currently we have a class going on at the Lansing City Market. It's a Cooking Matters for Families. We also do program instructions in the community centers around the city of Lansing and around Ingham County, and we do nutrition ed in the schools.
What would you say constitutes the core message here, or the core messages, let's say, being taught in SNAP Ed classes?
Eat healthy and be active.
It's always the two.
Yes.
The two together can work wonders. What are the MyPlate guidelines? Are they the same things as the food pyramid, or is this what the food pyramid has turned into?
So the food pyramid, if you remember in school, was that food guide pyramid that had the grains at the bottom and the sweets at the top, and that changed into My Pyramid a few years back, and then just recently we've went to something called the My Plate, and so My Plate is the new food guide, which has all the food groups on it, and so that shows, you know, the five food groups, and it's divided up in a way so that people can recognize that half of that plate should be fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it shows the five food groups: dairy, grains, fruits, vegetables, and proteins. And it shows on that My Plate how it's divided up, where, you know, that largest portion of your plate should be fruits and vegetables. A small portion should be protein. A small portion should be your grains, and then your dairy on the side.
I understand, and you may have alluded to this earlier as well, Joe, that the kids in your classes often go home, tell their parents about what they're learning, and you sometimes find this out when you bump into families at the grocery store.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's plenty of times, you know, in the classroom, we see the students. We don't see the families necessarily, and so you'll run into a student who will run up into a grocery store and give you a big hug, and you have mom and dad going, "Oh, you're Mr. Joe.
Oh,
you're
okay.
The reason we have to read every food label in the grocery store now." Or, "You're the reason that, you know, we have a fruit with breakfast every day now." Yeah. And it's, you know, it's nice because we see those as a positive outcome.
Annette, you alluded to the staying active. How do you go about that? What do you teach regarding being active and exercise?
So in the classrooms, we have several different ways. We have activity bands, stretchy bands that we bring into the classroom. We have dice that we roll on the floor that have, one has a one, you know, 1 through 6 number on it, and the other one has an exercise on it. And we have the kids then do that during our class time. And we talk about how many minutes per day they should get to be active every day. And we just kind of reinforce that messaging all the way through. In our Cooking Matters classes with adults, too, we talk about being active and staying physically fit and, you know, give out stretchy bands during that time also.
Joe talked about some of the feedback that he experiences. Mm-hmm. What feedback do you get?
Oh, when I go into a classroom and, you know, I see a mom and a child working at cutting up a chicken, and, you know, they both kind of have that really aha moment or smile on their face, like, "Oh, this is how you make all those pieces of a chicken." Or, you know, when you're going through the grocery store with them and they read the shelf tags and, you know, they realize that's what those tags are for, that they have unit per price per unit on them. So those are kind of fun. I have a class going on right now, and, you know, one of the participants in the class was just so thankful for the take-home groceries that they get, because they not only learn how to cook in the classroom, they take home groceries to practice their cooking skills at home. And she said what a difference it's made for her family to be able to take those groceries home and make that meal and have her family enjoy that.
When we talk about food insecurity, it's not just the issue of affordability, but also access sometimes. Nutritious food isn't always conveniently available in cities, and transportation can be an issue for some people. How serious a problem do you think food insecurity is here in Ingham County?
I think it is quite serious. I mean, we have some beautiful big box stores that have wonderful varieties of fruits and vegetables and whole grains and dairy. But in the inner cities of Lansing, it's really difficult to get to a full-service grocery store where they can be able to purchase all of the necessary things to complete a meal. So,
Joe, how big an issue is that in Shiawassee County, would you say? Do you have a feel for that?
I think it is a big issue. You know, I've asked family and friends and neighbors what they think some issues are, to some barriers to health. And you know, we do see transportation as an issue. And we have a great transportation system. But sometimes, you know, that $3 or $4 to take the local public bus is $3 or $4 in food that they can't spend then. Mm-hmm. And you know, so it becomes a cost issue. The little convenience stores are great, you know, for those quick need items, but they don't have the access to the fresh fruits and vegetables that they would get at a larger grocery store. And some smaller towns in our communities don't have a grocery store anymore. You know, those local grocery stores are going by the wayside. And if you've got to travel 15 to 20 minutes to your local grocery store or longer, it's just not a possibility, you know, on a week-by-week basis.
Is there a change that you see that you'd recommend in terms of food accessibility?
Well, I think the local farmers markets that are popping up all over are perfect because our participants can come. They are familiar with some of these fruits and vegetables now that we've demonstrated them in the classroom, and they can take those home and make a meal with those. So, and there are some smaller grocery stores opening up around the city, and some of our convenience stores are starting to carry some fruits and vegetables.
The name of this segment we call Neighbors in Action, which alludes to volunteerism. What role do volunteers play, and do you need volunteers?
We do need volunteers. All of our classes are taught with a volunteer chef. So we ask volunteers from the community that are either a, you know, pretty proficient home chef or a chef that works in a restaurant that'd like to give some time. And they come and teach a class with us. They're 6 weeks long, and there's lots of incentives to go along with that also.
I have been talking with Annette Sokolnicki, supervising educator for SNAP Ed and SNAP Ed nutrition program instructor Joe Hammontree about their programs here in mid-Michigan. Annette, Joe, good to hear about your program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR, there is a new book out that will appeal to our crime enthusiasts who are listening. It's based on murders that took place here in Michigan. Current State's Brooke Allen spoke with the author of Blood on the Mitten. Hi, Brooke.
Hey, good morning, Mark. And while horrifying, murder is somehow fascinating, especially when it is true and local, and that is exactly what Blood on the Mitten is all about. I spoke to the book's author, award-winning journalist Tom Carr, and Carr says some of Michigan's most notorious murders hit the national spotlight. One of them was The Burning Bed, starring Farrah Fawcett. The 1984 TV movie told the story of Dansville's Francine Hughes, who committed murder on March 9, 1977.
She had suffered 13 years of abuse from her husband. They had children together. She had filed for a divorce. He still wouldn't let her alone. And she saw only one way out. Tragically, she burned him as he slept.
You poured the gasoline around the bed, and then you lit a match and ran to the car, right?
Yes.
Okay, the kids were in the car, and they were scared and crying, and you started driving away. Francine, what were you doing? Where were you going?
Ran for my life. Ran for the life of my kids.
And took the kids and drove directly to the sheriff's office in Mason and turned herself in. But as the trial was happening, many women and others protested the case. And she ended up not being sent to prison, but they were. It helped to kind of highlight the problems that many abused spouses go through. The sort of no way out sense, and the fact that it kind of helped people to understand and to realize that these people need help, and that, you know, they shouldn't have to suffer it all alone and in isolation.
So you're a journalist and a reporter, and I have to ask you, as you're writing this book, do you ever get the chills doing the research on all of these cases?
Oh yeah, I did. And I had to take time, a little time away from it. I mean, this was my project in the winter, and if you can imagine, you know, a Michigan winter, working on something this dark.
No place is immune, but out of all the cases that you have followed, what stays with you, the people who commit the crime or the crime itself?
Well, it kind of depends on the case. Another one that's near Lansing is the Bath school murder. And the thing that's, I learned about that some 30 years ago when I saw the historical marker there, and I had never heard of it before. And this was in a time when we didn't have school massacres going on. And this was something that happened in 1927. A school board member blew up the school with the children inside. You know, in that case, it the personality, the weird, you know, just the unusual personality of the killer, plus the fact that anybody could be so upset about taxes that they could do something so horrible, or just be upset about anything that they could do, take it out on a school full of children. So it's hard to say whether it's the people. Sometimes it's the victims. Sometimes it's the perpetrator and their strange personalities and how people maybe should have seen that this could happen. And sometimes it's the reaction of the people around.
I am speaking to Michigan journalist and author Tom Carr, who has written Blood on the Mitten and, of course, a book about infamous Michigan murders based from the 1700s to present. And Tom, you're going to go ahead and give us a little sampling of what you've written.
This is titled Bloodbath. It's about the massacre, the school massacre in 1927 in the town of Bath. The worst mass murder of school children in U.S. history was committed by an anti-tax school board member in danger of losing his farm. Sound like recent history? Guess again. This was May 1927, 2 days before Charles Lindbergh set off on his historic transatlantic flight. The killer was Andrew Kehoe, born in Tecumseh, a graduate of Michigan State, a farmer and a bit of a dandy. He used to drive a tractor in an immaculate vested suit and freshly shined shoes. His tractors were state-of-the-art for the day, shiny like they'd just come from a showroom. That did make other farmers lift their sweated caps and scratch their heads, but he made friends, in part, by sharing his explosives expertise whenever someone needed a tree stump removed. His Fourth of July celebrations made people jump for miles around. But the farmers were right. There was something different about Kehoe. For one thing, he was mean as dirt and was once observed beating a horse to death. When he was a teenager, the kitchen stove exploded, spraying his stepmother with fuel oil and then caught on fire. He unhelpfully threw water on her, and there was his wife, fading away slowly and expensively by tuberculosis. About the time he stopped paying his mortgage, he also lost his treasurer position on the school board. Voters were tired of his relentless fight against taxes of all kinds, particularly the millage proposal to build a new school. Slow-burning resentment and Kehoe's quiet, murderous way were about to blow up.
I am speaking to Michigan journalist and author Tom Carr, who has written Blood on the Mitten, a book about infamous Michigan murders based from the 1700s to present. What is so intriguing about crime and murder? And is it the combination of the history or is it always, I just remember growing up and you always hear people say, oh, but it's a true story. So I love it. You know, what is it about that?
Yeah, I think it is fascinating, and I found, you know, that people are fascinated by it. To say that, you know, you're driving, for instance, up in northern Michigan on one of the most beautiful drives in the state, and to know that just off of this drive, this would be the scenic drive that sometimes called the Tunnel of Trees between Harbor Springs and Cross Village and north of Petoskey. And you think, well, just off of this beautiful drive here, there was a murder of an entire family back in 1968 that is still unsolved. And it kind of gives you chills. And it's just, I don't know, it's not like, you know, enjoyable, but it's something that just fascinates people.
And by no means, I don't want anyone to think that you're making light of the victims by any means.
That was the main thing. I am actually in here, and I think say this in the introduction. At times I'm irreverent in this book, but never at the expense of the victims. I was very careful not to do that because the book is dedicated to the victims, and I don't ever want to make light of anybody's suffering.
Right. And again, I'm speaking to Tom Carr, author of Blood on the Mitten, a new book, and they are, of course, based on the Michigan murder spanning nearly three centuries. For Current State, I'm Brooke Allen.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Coming up Thursday on Current State, Lansing City Council member Adam Hussein joins us. We will talk about several issues facing the city of Lansing here this year. We've had an ongoing conversation involving the troubled South Washington Park apartments and changes that need to be take place there. Also, new projects on the south side of the city in his ward and a new marijuana ordinance in the city. We will run the gamut here with Adam Hussein tomorrow. Plus, how do you keep a 120-year-old play fresh? That's the aim of the Brass Tacks Ensemble of Ann Arbor this weekend at the Carytown Concert House. We'll speak with the troupe's artistic director about their upcoming production of Oscar Wilde's classic, The Importance of Being Earnest. That and more Thursday here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed the program today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast contains everything that we do here on Current State, informative, insightful, indispensable with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. Politics and education, health care, science, tech, theater, music, stories from all around the state, and Eaton, Clinton, and Ingham County as well. That's the Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Glad you could join us today. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.